Thank you. So this is a project that actually grew out of a coffee discussion at IAS, and it's something I'm working on with Nadia Zakamta, who's still at IAS, and with Eric. So I guess all of us have become pretty friendly with these two plots over the last couple of weeks, but this is just the eccentricity versus semi-major axis scatter plot for the radial velocity planets. As of last Thursday, there are 303 of them. And on the right is the cumulative distribution of eccentricities. I would say that, at least in terms of population statistics, this is one of the most interesting things to come out of the radial velocity studies. It looks nothing like our solar system, and so lots of people have spent a fair amount of time and effort trying to figure out how to get them. So this is just meant to be a schematic summary of what some people have proposed. So you can have planet-planet scattering. You can have, yes? Thank you. Okay, so you can have planet-planet scattering. You can have more long-term, like secular-type interactions with other planets. You could have interactions with a disk. You can have some combination of these, maybe to excite the eccentricities and then damp them. You can also imagine that, well, since we think stars form in a cluster, there are other stars nearby. You might have some sort of binary or triple system. You might be in a cluster of stars, so you'd have lots of passing stars. You would get Kozai effects. So there are many different mechanisms, and there's been a lot of work on it, some of which we've heard about in much more detail recently. So given this extensive body of work, it's natural, I think, to ask the question, you know, to what extent can we trust this distribution as a given? So, you know, where are there any biases in this and these eccentricities that are given to us? And as theorists, we just sort of say, okay, this is it, and we compare all our theoretical results to it. Okay, so people have looked into this. So there's one question is, when you try to actually detect these planets, are you likely to find more eccentric planets, just be able to detect those planets more easily or less easily than more circular planets? And the answer seems to be not really. So this is just one plot I took from one of these studies. This happens to be Shen and Turner. And you should just look at the solid black line. And that's the detection efficiency of the function of eccentricity. And you can see it goes down slightly as eccentricity increases. And that's because if you're a very eccentric planet, right, there can be no radial velocity signal for most of the orbit, and then a very strong radial velocity signal near periaps. So you have to be looking at the right time. On the other hand, the amplitude, the radial velocity amplitude associated with that is usually larger than for a comparable circular orbit planet. So those two effects kind of cancel one another out, and so you get a detection efficiency that's mostly flat. So we wanted to look at a slightly different question, and that's so are there any biases introduced by the way you extract the orbit parameters, specifically the eccentricities, from the radial velocity data you get? And in particular, you might think that there would be, because especially for nearly circular planets, the eccentricity can't go below zero, so you know your data are imperfect, there are uncertainties, and so when you fit the orbit, an imperfect fit will tend to drive an eccentricity higher if it's naturally near zero. So with this in mind, we wanted to try to quantify this whatever biases might be introduced by the eccentricity extraction process. Okay, so well, we're at least half theorists, I guess. So we decided to try this by running a simulation, essentially. So what we did was say, okay, let's generate a mock catalog of planets and just analyze it and see what we get. Okay, so the idea is very simple. Then we realized that to generate a realistic catalog of mock exoplanets, there are actually a lot of variables that you need to take into account. There's the cadence of observations. There's the sizes of the uncertainties in your measurements. There's the, you know, what's the balance of active stars and not so active stars, or different kinds of stars in your sample. What's the distribution of velocity amplitudes that you should expect? And so we said, okay, we won't try to make a model of all those things. Instead, we'll just take a catalog and just take the observations, much of the observational data, just straight from that. So at the time we started this,
can you explain how star activity enters?
Okay, so you might think that will add some noise, right, to your radial velocity measurement. So what distribution of kinds of stars should you take in your sample when you're generating the radial velocities with their noise? So what we did was say, okay, we won't try to specify these ourselves a priori. We'll just use real observations. That's pretty much as close a model to the real thing as we can get. So when we started this, the biggest sort of compilation of these sorts of things was this catalog published by Butler et al. In 2006. There are, I think, 172 planets in this catalog, but we took a subset of 91 systems. I think they have about 150 systems, but some of them are multiple, so 172 planets. So we took 91 of these systems. First of all, because we wanted to take most of the parameters straight from those data, we needed systems that had public radial velocity data. And not all of those too. And also, we took systems with fewer than 90 observations, just so that our data analysis would be tractable. So there are 91 systems like that in this catalog, and we just took the orbit parameters of the largest planet. We retained the period, the velocity amplitude, the observation times, and the absolute value of the uncertainties that are just listed for those planets in this catalog. But we put in our own eccentricities. For each of the 91 systems, we tried 5 different eccentricities, 0, 0.05, 0.1, 0.3, and 0.6. And for each of those 5 eccentricities, we had 5 different systems where the noise was put in a little bit differently. So that was just to get a handle on, you know, how reliable is our measurement for each of those 5 eccentricities, just to make sure, sort of a sanity check.
Have you put in the other planets when they have them as they are?
No. So we treat all these systems as single planet systems. So when I say we took the dominant planet, I just mean we took the orbit period and the velocity amplitude associated with that planet. And we took the uncertainty from the radial velocity total measurement, of course.
For RV, does the argument of Riastrin matter?
Yes. So we took that from the
okay,
measurements
so you kept
as well.
That measurement.
Yeah. So you might think in particular that would matter for the observational cadence, right? For eccentric planets, you might want to observe more around periaps, for example. Yeah. So we just kept that.
So I'm still confused about what you do exactly. So you take these parameters, then you vary the eccentricity, and you generate fake RV. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We generate fake RV velocities. We just take those parameters and
generate. How do you put the noise on this?
Okay, so we take the amplitude of the noise, that uncertainty, the magnitude of the uncertainty, just from the RV, from the published data sets. Then we assume that that's a Gaussian random variable, mm-hmm. and we add physical noise from the star, which they also use as a parameter in their analysis. And then, so because it's a Gaussian random variable, we just pick, just a random number, and we do that for each of 5 different realizations. Yeah, so that's the 5 data sets for each of the eccentricities. Okay, so now when you do that, you get almost 2,300 mock data sets. Okay, so The way we do the orbit element extraction is by Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. I'm not going to say a whole lot about this, except to say, just to show three sample, these are just the eccentricity data from three sample chains. These all happen to be for input eccentricity zero. But this is mostly to show that the chains are pretty well behaved. This is typical, I would say. Except for, I think it's 3% of systems, 3% of the 2300 systems didn't converge. So the vast majority of them were pretty well behaved. And, I'm going to use these three as examples in the next slide. The first sort of non-immediate thing that you run into when you do this analysis is what eccentricity measure best represents the information of that you're getting from the samples in each chain. Okay, so since we think that this affects how biased your eccentricity measurement might be, we wanted to be a little bit careful about this. So we tried several different things. Let me split up this group of plots here. If you look just at the left column of plots, okay. So again, this is sample chain 1, sample chain 2, sample chain 3. Just the left column here, this is just the eccentricity information from those chains. So you marginalize the chains over all the parameters except for eccentricity. And then you make histograms of what values you get. So remember, for all of these, the input eccentricity was 0. You can't measure an eccentricity that's less than 0. So you get this distribution which sort of, in these two cases at least, peaks near 0 or at very small values of the eccentricity and then tails off. So I think if you do the most simple-minded thing, right, is to say, okay, this chain gives me a whole bunch of samples representing some eccentricity distribution. What is the summary statistic that says what this chain is saying? Well, the simple thing is to say, well, it's the mean eccentricity value or the median eccentricity value, right? And you can see right away that for these two cases, if you pick the mean value in this chain or the median value, you're not going to get 0. You'll probably get something around here, say. So you can already see there's probably some sort of bias introduced there. So for this one, you know, you might get something a little more reasonable. All right, what else can you try?
Why do you say it's more reasonable?
Excuse me?
Why do you say it's more reasonable, this one?
Well, so this one, for this one.
It's zero eccentricity case?
Yeah, so the input eccentricity was 0, but for some reason the chain decided that the best fidelity was not 0. Okay, so this is something to do with the data set.
Well, it looks like it has something to do with the beginning, because you will get, even if you have 0 is the most likely in the H and K plane, you can have this linear ramp up, and then it turns over, and that turnover can be within the first bin or not. And if it's not in the first bin,
even if
it's centered, now that's not quite centered, but even if it were, the size of that scatter plot, characteristic size, seems to be a little larger.
Okay, so in some cases that might be the case, but I think for this particular case it is not. Because you can see here, so this is exactly what you described. It's the scatter plot in the HK plane where H is E sine the longitude of periastron, K is E cosine. Mm-hmm. And this blue cross here, that's the input value 0. And you can see that the chain really thinks that the value is somewhere here. Yeah. Okay, so yeah.
I'm a little perplexed that the scale is, oh, I see, your bidding is different.
Yes. Okay, so another measure you might consider is the mode of just the eccentricities. You can see that for low eccentricity cases, that ought to behave better. It ought to give a value that's closer to 0. Right, so that's one other thing we looked at. Another thing you can do is to say, well, let's spread this execution data out onto a plane, like we were just discussing. So you can add in the data on the longitude of periastron, or what you've derived about the longitude of periastron, and use it to make these new values, h and k, defined here as we just said. And so that gives you these plots on the right here. So these are basically projections. So these are the scatter plots in the h and k plane, and these are projections of that information. So you can see here, you don't get this asymmetry around zero. So you might think that using this two-dimensional measure is inherently less biased as well as just, you know, simple-mindedly taking the mean or the median. Okay, so we looked at all of these things, and this is what we got. So again, let's start with the top row here. This is just what happens when you look at the eccentricities alone without the longitude of periastron information. So there are three measures there. There's the E mean, E median, and E mode. There's a histogram for each of those in each of these plots, because this is for eccentricity, input eccentricity 0, this is for 0.05 and 0.3. Okay, so you can see right away that E mean and E median are quite biased toward higher values. Okay, so I should say this is the output eccentricity, the E mean or E median or E mode, minus the input eccentricity over the uncertainty. So this is all normalized to the uncertainty. So you can see that E mean and E median tend to be too large by actually something like 1.5 sigma. So it's significantly biased for when the input eccentricity is 0. E mode, on the other hand, behaves relatively well compared to that. And you can see there's still a slight bias for an input eccentricity of 0.05, but less of 1. So the red and black histograms are shifted a bit to the right. The blue histogram is more centered. And once you get to larger eccentricities, there's basically no bias. You're not hit by this this hard edge at En equals 0 anymore. Okay, so the bottom row of plots is for the measures of eccentricity using h and k. You can see for En equals 0, h and k are doing better than E mean and E median. But a bit to our surprise, not as well as E mode. And again, for E equals 0.05, the bias is considerably less. And for En equals 0.3, there's basically no bias. Okay, so from our conclusion from this is, if you have a data set, you want to measure the eccentricity, especially if the eccentricity is low, you're least likely to be affected by bias if you use E mode. So it's actually not that much more complicated to calculate than E median or E mean. So this is what we recommend. Okay. So how does this stack up with the published eccentricities? There were 91 systems from the Butler 2006 catalog that we used, right? Of those 91 systems, 63 are single planet systems. And so we ran the same analysis, the Markov chain Monte Carlo, on those real data, now with the real eccentricities, and we compared our eccentricity measures with the eccentricities that are actually published in the catalog. Okay, so here I'm just showing the results for RE mean and RE mode. Okay, and so first look at these plots on the left. This is a histogram of this E mean minus the published eccentricity in the catalog over the uncertainty. Okay, so we see that E mean is basically comparable statistically to the Butler catalog eccentricities. They behave statistically in the same way. So the black The black histogram here is all 63 systems. The blue histogram is when you have low eccentricities, and the green histogram is for the higher eccentricities. So they're basically all peaked around zero. When you use E mode, on the other hand, so this is the same histogram but with E mode instead of E mean, you see that for low eccentricities in particular, you get smaller results with E mode than the Butler catalog does. That suggests that indeed for low eccentricities, the Butler data are biased high. You can see the effect for high eccentricities is basically none. But there are enough low eccentricity systems that the bias for the entire set is not zero. Okay, and these plots on the right are just to show that the R uncertainties are statistically very similar to the Butler quoted eccentricities. So it's not that we somehow have different eccentricity uncertainties than they do. It's really just a question of the bias.
So when people quote eccentricities, usually they have like asymmetric error bars for low eccentricity. So doesn't that sort of, as long as you're, I mean, if you're just kind of making a plot where you're considering just their best fit eccentricity, then people might be biased high. But if you actually put the error bar on that, then presumably the error bar is asymmetric, and I mean, doesn't that kind of compensate for this effect? Like,
so okay,
insofar as it's kind of like a, I mean, it's not Gaussian looking when it's smushed up next to zero, right. It's asymmetric, but I thought that was the whole point of quoting those asymmetric error bars, was that they're somehow implicitly.
So, okay, I'm not familiar with specific cases, like I don't remember any specific, but my impression is that they tend to be asymmetric the wrong way, kind of. Like, they tend to be smaller on the small side and larger on the large side.
Oh, okay.
And that actually goes the other way.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So there's some evidence that in the population, at least, there's some bias toward higher eccentricities for a low eccentricity system. Okay. So we can try to quantify that. How biased is it? How many more low eccentricity systems should you expect in a catalog like the Butler 2006 one? And so we have, because we've run this experiment with the 2,300 sample systems, we have some information on this. So we have a fifth of those had input eccentricity zero, and we analyze them. And so we say, what's the distribution of eccentricities that we measure given an input eccentricity of zero? And we can do that for each of these five input eccentricity values, right? And so here's the data on that here. These are just the points, all the points here. So the points in the top plot are the same as the points in the bottom plot. Okay, but you know, if we want to apply this to the Butler data set, we don't expect it only to have five eccentricities. We expect some sort of continuous distribution of eccentricities. So what we would like is to parameterize this function of, okay, given an input eccentricity, what's the distribution of output eccentricities you should measure for any input eccentricity? So we would like to find some sort of simple analytic form to approximate this function. And the thing recommended in this previous paper by Chen and Turner, they analyzed just one system in which they varied in many different ways, was that you might expect, at least for small eccentricities, that H and K might be distributed in a Gaussian way. So what you should do is kind of translate that two-dimensional Gaussian into a probability distribution for eccentricities. But we found that when you try to do that, you don't get things that fit well, especially for low input eccentricities, which is where most of the bias comes. So we aren't using this two-dimensional Gaussian thing. Instead, we're assuming that that H and K are distributed like exponentials, and that seems to work much better. You better reproduce these sort of long tails of the distribution. Okay, so you take this probability distribution, which we're saying is this integral of exponentials,
precisely is the form of the exponential?
Excuse me?
What precisely is the form of the exponential?
Okay, so so it's async, yeah. So what you have is h goes as the exponential of the absolute value of h minus h naught over some width. Okay, I shouldn't say that. Just k. Pardon? And the same with k. Yeah. And so then you integrate that over the longitude of periastron, basically, to get a distribution for just the eccentricity.
Is there any physical motivation for
what? For this exponential? No. It just you can see that the Gaussians don't work, and so we needed something with longer tails. If you try a Lorentzian, for example, that has the tails are much too big, so you need something in between. And,
like a Landau distribution or even Poisson?
Okay, I don't know. I didn't try those, but yeah.
Gaussians probably would be what you get if you had truly white noise.
Yes.
And you need something with a longer tail, and what that thing is with a longer tail, this happens to work.
Yeah, basically that's it, yeah.
You might try a Poisson distribution.
Pardon?
Try a Poisson distribution.
Yeah, we didn't.
Well, so for large eccentricities, it should be vaguely close to symmetric, right? So for small eccentricities, you might make all the weird shapes, and since it needs to be a funny shape, maybe that's good. But for large eccentricities, you want it to be vaguely symmetric. So that rules out things that don't have a difference in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Okay, so you take these probability distributions, you apply them to that cumulative distribution, this curve here, and you see what you get out. Okay, so when you do that, this is what happens. So what you get is this white line here, actually. And the catalog values give this distribution here, this orange line. So you can see that at small eccentricities, they're actually different. The inversion, like what we would call the estimated underlying distribution, is considerably higher than the published values. And here are the sort of the numbers for small eccentricities. So the fraction of eccentricities lower than 0.02, we get something like 27%. The nominal values will give you about 6%. For eccentricities, the fraction of systems with the fraction of planets, single planets with eccentricities lower than 0.05, we get almost 40%, whereas the nominal number is 17%. So so maybe the solar system is not as weird as we originally thought. Okay, so you can do the same thing for planets that are longer periods. So cutting out, if you just want to look at the population of planets that are probably not affected by tidal circularization, and the answers are similar. The effect is basically the same. Okay. All right. So I guess one extra thing that we kind of get for free is that since we have all these mock systems, we analyze them, we can look at what makes for good quality extracted orbit parameters. So you can think of the ways to parameterize the quality of the output parameters are just basically the precision, this uncertainty, and well, the bias, which we've talked about. The ways to parameterize how good your input data are would be things like the effect of signal to noise, the number of periods you cover, the largest gap in phase coverage that your data set has, maybe the number of observations in your data set. So we just looked at all the correlations that you can get between the output and the input quality parameters. And so you see that, these this one, and this one, these four here, are the strongest correlations that we saw. The eccentricity precision. Okay, I'll talk about this later. The point of these two is just to show that if you just we don't see a correlation between the quality of the output. So this is the eccentricity uncertainty, and this is the period uncertainty versus the number of observations. So you would naturally think that if you increase the number of observations in a single system, you're going to get better quality data. But because we're looking at a whole bunch of systems, because this is kind of an ensemble averaged experiment, there are different variables that come in. It's not just increasing the number of observations. You can't translate that directly into better precision. Okay, as for the other ones, so this gives us some feeling for a sort of seat of the pants recommendations. If you're an observer and you're trying to decide, should I, you know, put in an extra half an hour and get another radial velocity measurement of this star, how much will that actually improve my data set? We hope this will sort of be a rough guide to how good your output will be given your input data. So if you want eccentricity uncertainty of less than about 0.05, you need your effective signal to noise, which is this quantity, to be bigger than about 40. And you have similar recommendations for the period. Turns out if you want your period uncertainty to be less than about a tenth, then you only need one period. And if you increase that by just a factor of two, if you can get two periods, you're probably doing better than 1%. Okay, and then also for the velocity amplitude, if you want velocity amplitude uncertainty of less than about 3 meters per second, you can't have a phase gap of more than a few tenths. So that's just basically something we got for free.
And on other things. So
yes, they do.
For example, the middle ones there. And when we did a simulation of how well you can recover orbital parameters from a combination of astrometry and radial velocity, for either one of them, that exact expression, the uncertainty in the period divided by the period, depends upon the signal-to-noise ratio as well as the length of the period of the number of periods that you're observing in time over.
Yes, very much so.
And it decays very rapidly as soon as you get one or less period of time.
Right.
So.
Yes, so.
You can actually derive analytical expressions for those things.
Oh, okay. So I'm not trying to claim that this is those are the only things that they depend on. Just that this is just sort of
that
a seat of pants indication.
Set, those numbers apply. I see.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So I thought I should mention the probably the closest related study that has been performed recently is this one by Shen and Turner. What they did basically is they took two systems from this Butler catalog, and then they varied all the parameters. So they varied the eccentricity, and independently they varied the period, or they varied the number of observations, and so on. So their study is really looking at, what happens to a single system. How does the quality of the output depend directly on each of these parameters, these input parameters? Our experiment is more of a population experiment. How does the eccentricity distribution, how is it affected by this bias? So they also found that if you have a signal to noise that's too low, and not enough data points, then you will indeed get an eccentricity bias. So to the extent that our experiments overlap, we basically agree.
Shannon Turner's work, I know it's somebody else's work, but do you remember how many degrees of freedom they have? How many parameters?
Okay, so they definitely varied the eccentricity. They varied the number of observations.
Are you asking about what they varied, or how many parameters there were in each individual?
How many parameters?
Okay.
Roughly then six.
Okay. Okay, and so that's about it. So we find that for low eccentricities, indeed, as you expect, just doing the simple-minded thing and taking the mean or median eccentricity, is you'll get a bias. And we think that just taking the mean or median is consistent with what people really do when they run these surveys. Okay, so instead, we recommend that you use E-mode. Okay, as a result, we think that the true fraction of low eccentricity planets is probably a bit larger than is reported. Okay, things we can do in future, we can apply our results to the larger set of planets that now exists. And in fact, I'm trying to do this. Like as I showed in the beginning, the eccentricity distribution of the current planets and the one of the Butler 2006 catalog are not that different. So I'm curious as to whether the statistics improve if I try to do the inversion with a larger number of planets. Another thing that we haven't considered at all is what happens if you have a different planet in the system. How does that affect your eccentricity biases? So that's it. Thank you. Yeah.
Why do people always look at the cumulative distribution function? Is that just because it's strictly positive? Why are there any good reason why it flows?
As opposed to
like the number of planets within a certain range of eccentricity, either in log or.
Yeah, so then involves spinning, right? If you really thought your sample was, you know, everything was very well sampled, that would make sense. But you know, if you have sort of 63 eccentricities, then this gets around the problem of how big should I make my bins? What binning system should I use? That's why we use it.
So a few years ago, or maybe more than a few years ago, I believe there was a paper that included John Chambers about the fact that mean motion resonances at low eccentricity could lead you to overestimate the eccentricity of some system because you were doing a one Kepler field while there were really two planets in mean motion resonances, and around low eccentricity, maybe 0.1, 0.2, I barely remember, you could get confused.
Right.
So so it's different from what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's a physical bias in your model. Your model is
wrong. Yes.
But do you think some of that? I mean, what's the story about that? Do you think that is correct? Actually, that we might be misinterpreting a number of.
Yeah. So you can imagine if you have So let's say you have one planet on a nearly circular orbit, and then another one in a 2-to-1 meteor ocean. So if your data are not super good, then it'll just look like you're adding to the second harmonic of the orbit period. And that's exactly what a moderate eccentricity does if your data aren't too good. So I think it's a totally reasonable concern.
So you may be correcting the eccentricity for some of the systems here.
Yeah, so in this experiment, we are only looking at single planet systems, right? So it's
single
right.
But that's the point. You're correcting.
Okay, so
your assumption that it is single planets, and you're like correcting, assuming the single planet. I'm just wondering how frequently this physical bias that we just talked about.
So you're asking a thing about model misspecification.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how frequent could we be wrong about it?
So her future work is to think about this, but. I mean, in principle, if you really were hiding Earths or asteroids or C1 motion, we'd never know. So, except for the system where you have transits.
So we're truly blind to this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you get good enough data, right? If you have enough radio velocity,
right,
then you'll be able to differentiate that one.
But once you get to eccentricities of 0.1 or 0.5, it's really hard to tell. I mean, even if you have a nice signal to noise of 20, mm-hmm. you add an eccentricity of 0.5, and you're saying, could I detect something with signal to noise of 1? No.
Yeah, so there's also a question of how many resonant systems are there, and we don't really know.
Right.
So. Yes.
You probably said this and I missed it, but what is the trend? Is the function of the order periods or Sammons rises?
The trend in?
Trends in the eccentricity distributions and the bias you might detect.
Okay, so we didn't, find any trends in the bias with the number of periods or the semi-major axis distribution. So we only, it seems only to vary with the signal to noise. And is that what you were asking? Okay.
This redness of the noise, I'm wondering if there's any way you can use that. And one of the things that's mentioned is occasionally you're going to have resonant systems which will induce a systematic bias, even if they're really small planets.
Yes.
And then other planets that are out there, just other periodicities that the star might have.
I don't know if you could differentiate between those in the noise characteristics of the tails.
Typical RV data set is very small compared to what people are used to when they think of doing time series analysis and other problems.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we didn't feel so bad about throwing away all the systems with more than 90 observations. Like here, most of the systems in your catalog are going to be the ones that are sort of, they have a planet, you can tell there's a planet, you have some handle on the parameters, but not, Yeah.
So what would your recommendation be for an observer to try and figure out if there is a bias in the data? I mean, it seems like a few random bad data points could skew the result toward a substantially positive eccentricity. And how should the, I could imagine, for example, that you would take your radio velocity data and look at the signal to noise at each point and then randomly change to a different noise value, but in concert with that same signal to noise ratio or exchange error bars or something like that, and average together a couple thousand of these things by that bootstrap method, and then do what you did, which is a sort of an averaging of the vector result of the eccentricity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea whether that would help matters? I mean, you could actually do an experiment to try that out.
To
simulate the data, instead of saying, here's your set of data, and here I have, 90 data points, and here's the noise on each one of them, and sometimes they're bigger and sometimes they're smaller. And so the question would be, well, could I rearrange the noise values so that instead of, a noise of 0.1 over on this data point, I put in a different value that was sort of in concert with the same signal to noise ratio that we think that we have on that measurement, because after all, noise is just, it's a random number. Is there a way of trying to bootstrap your way out of this by playing with the data?
I'm not totally sure. So are you asking, can you have a...
Can you start better, get a better estimate of electricity by bootstrapping?
Normally you would definitely get a better estimate of your error bars. I don't know if...
You can't get something with nothing.
Will it reduce the bias? That's, because it's got an intrinsic bias built in here.
You have to be careful about it. There's the question of when you have an individual system and you want to say things about this system.
Yeah.
So if you put in a certain set of assumptions, priors, noise, projects, and so forth, then the posterior distribution bit is the best thing you can do for those assumptions. What this is looking at is when I'm no longer asking questions about an individual planet, but rather saying, I have this catalog of planets. And even if every planet had been measured...
Yeah, I understand. That's what she was doing. But I'm asking, can you get a better estimate for each individual element that went into that catalog in the first place? Could you tell that you were building in... What you're saying is that you're building in an obvious bias towards a positive eccentricity or a larger value than zero if they were all zero. And it would be good to have a better error bar on the number that you put into your catalog then.
It sounds to me like if the observer has just quoted the mode eccentricity either instead or as well as the mean and the median eccentricity, then theorists could use that and it would actually work. The cumulative distribution of eccentricities would be correct. I think that was my understanding. At least it would be more correct than what people are using now.
Yeah.
So it's not like the observers don't even have to rerun their Markov chains. They just have to like quote a different number out of it, mm-hmm. which sounds easy to me.
Kind of what, so I think what you suggested would say, okay, maybe the error bars were bigger than we thought, or maybe they're more asymmetric than we thought.
Yeah.
But
what you're saying is the assumptions were wrong.
Yeah.
And what I would say is the experimenter should understand the noise better and then let us know what the noise properties are, and there's no problem. The problem is the experimenter is clueless about what the noise is.
You never know what you're doing.
and then, I mean, who knows what you're doing? You just make a random jump. That's it.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, this is, if I had been more alert, I would know the answer, but E-mode.
Yes.
Is that the scalar E-mode or the vector E-mode?
The scalar. So you take your chain, you marginalize over everything except eccentricity. So all you have left is the scalar value of the eccentricity, and then you find the mode of that distribution.
And what if you did it for vector E-mode?
Yes, we tried it, but okay, so this gets a little technical. So the way we ran the Markov chains was to assume priors that are flat in eccentricity and longitude periastron. And then from that, construct H and K. And when you do that, you're switching between coordinate systems such that there's a singularity at equals zero. And that messes up the mode calculation in H and K. So we tried that, saw that there was a problem, and we didn't use it. So you could, when you analyze your chains, instead of assuming flat priors in eccentricity and longitude of periastron, assume flat priors in H and K. That's not the experiment we did.
That's also, you have one of your biases.
Yes. Yeah, that's a different bias, that's true.
It's a different one. That could affect your results.
And of course, the choice of prior makes a big difference on your result.
Right.
If, for example, you put in a distribution that had 40% circular planets instead of flat, that would dramatically increase the fraction that come out as being nearly circular.
Right, but you're putting in a prior. I'm wondering how much of this comes out from your prior.
Well, okay, so if you assume flat prior is in H and K, right, you're basically assigning zero parameter space to eccentricity zero orbits. And
yeah.
That doesn't seem right, right?
So, I mean, if anything, you guys should have been biased towards higher eccentricities like other people. I mean, that's what your prior would have been doing if it was uniform. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you got smaller eccentricities than the quoted ones.
Your prior is uniform, is weighted in HK space. Your prior is peaked at the origin.
Yes.
And therefore, are you introducing a bias to lower E?
So I think the answer is we are not introducing a bias toward lower E relative to what observers actually do. I don't think they assume flat priors in H and K. So I think this is representative of what people actually do when they look for eccentricities. They don't, they don't assign zero parameter space to equal zero.
To know what they're saying is biased, you have to know what the actual value is. Right? So So if all planets are circular, then anything that assigns non-zero probability to non-zero orbits is biased. Okay. If no planets are really circular, then so you have to be careful when you say things like, well, of course it's biased. The question is, how does your bias perform in light of imperfect information? And so the goal is not to make it perfect, but rather have an estimate that's robust to the types of noise and other stuff that you're likely to encounter.
I mean, there's a limit because the way these observations are done
sure.
is they home in on interesting things, and that can be interesting parts of an orbit in addition just to interesting systems. So you would need psychology, radio philosophy.
This is Margaret.